When people say that you created the best TV series ever, how do you top that?
At some point, you have to not care. You have to believe in the story and not look over your shoulder. The last thing that we can do is sort of look back at The Wire and go, what did they like about The Wire? And can we put some of that in Treme? I mean, you know, this is another story.
Today in Studio 360, I'll talk with the writer and producer David Simon. His new HBO show, Treme, is set in post-Katrina New Orleans. And to be a rock musician in Iran, you got to be fearless.
I was arrested in some rock concert outside of Tehran, and I spent 21 days in prison.
Indie rockers from Tehran. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, I'll talk with a pair of indie rock musicians from Iran. Now that they're freshly living in exile in London, being independent means something very different.
Here we can do music faster and very perfect. But in Iran, we used to do music with adventure.
But first, we'll head down to New Orleans. It's late in 2005, 3 months after Hurricane Katrina.
Well, I knew you'd come back. Yeah, I knew you'd never leave. You know it'd take more than a hurricane to pry me out of New Orleans. So what? Beer? Gin? Juice? What you need?
Water, son.
Water?
I could use a bath.
That's from the new HBO series Treme. It's the latest from David Simon, who's best known for creating The Wire, the extraordinary series about drug dealing and policing and corruption in Baltimore. Both creators of Treme, David Simon as well as Eric Overmyer, are here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Now, when the show begins, one of the first characters we meet is a jazz trombonist played by Wendell Pierce, who people will remember as Bunk from The Wire. Let's listen to a clip of him. This is where he's taken a taxi across the city and doesn't quite have the full fare.
Look, it's $24 right now, goddammit.
I got you, bro. I got you covered. I'm leaving my damn bone, man. You know, if I'm leaving my bone in your damn cab, I ain't running out on you.
12:30,
1
for
10.
24.
Oh, listen, that's another thing. I don't know about all that $24 from the Paris line. You had listened to me and taken Earhart, you wouldn't have run into all that mess on Claiborne.
That is Wendell Pierce in the new HBO series Treme. You specifically wrote that character for him, yeah?
Absolutely. Wendell is from New Orleans, native, and his parents actually lost their home in Pontchartrain Park, the neighborhood where he grew up.
Right down from the lake.
Yeah, they were flooded out. So this project was really in concert with Wendell and his feelings about New Orleans. And I think I would have liked to have seen Eric and I try to write this and not have a part for Wendell.
Yeah, David says Wendell would have hunted us down and killed us if we'd done it without him.
And did you create the character with him and say, Wendell, what do you want to do? Or did you just say, hey, we got this trombone player who screws around?
I sort of imagined him playing the trombone. I think in some way, there's something delightful about the trombone. I can't quite explain it except
it's a somewhat comical instrument.
Yes.
And just for starts.
When you pitched Treme to HBO, what was the capsule pitch?
Oh, God. It was a reflection on the post-Katrina history of New Orleans as told through ordinary people, most of whom were involved in the culture of New Orleans, which is an extraordinary thing. But as it stood as a pitch, Eric and I were probably a hilarious failure that day. We went into Carolyn Strauss's office.
Who was in charge of HBO at that time?
Yeah, programming. We tried to explain what we were intending on doing. She looked at us with, I think, all the sympathy she could muster and said, okay, just write it.
She said, I've never been to New Orleans. I have no idea what a Mardi Gras Indian is.
Really?
I have no idea what you're talking about. She actually said that. Yeah. So go write it.
Did you guys both go down after you pitched this and HBO said, okay, write it? And did you go down and spend time in New Orleans to sort of figure out what it should be?
Yes. I was visiting fairly regularly to try to, in some ways, you're trying to track the narrative of the storm and its aftermath, because that is the spine of the story.
I mean, it starts 3 months after Katrina.
Right. And you know, I think in some ways, the story kept changing in front of our eyes in terms of the expectation of what might come back or what didn't come back or came back on what terms. The distance of doing this 5 years later and trying to recount that is extremely helpful.
There's an arc a bit to what has happened or hasn't happened, right, or surprisingly happened.
Right. I mean, one of the big themes of Treme is the idea that it's actually the culture that saved the city, that, you know, government, economic imperatives, all these things really didn't matter. What mattered was the culture. The culture was something that nobody had the ability to discard. Those people who were involved in it, those people who loved it, they just had to do it.
Most HBO viewers didn't know Baltimore, probably hadn't been to Baltimore, had no fixed ideas about it. Probably most HBO viewers, your executive aside, have been there or know about it. Does that create a whole different set of challenges on creating
this? I don't
think
so, because I don't think they actually ever... I think the vast majority of people who travel to New Orleans don't get out of the French Quarter.
Absolutely.
Or the Garden District. And we sort of rigorously avoided those places except for a handful of scenes. We're after the living city of New Orleans rather than the tourist version.
And people have said to us, I hope you're not doing X or Y. You're not going to shoot the fan overhead while
somebody's, the sweat runs
while
down.
The sweat runs down. Exactly.
Yeah. Eric, you've lived there. You've had a second home there. Does that immunize you guys from being considered some kind of creative carpetbaggers in New Orleans?
Oh, no, not at all. I think they've been very, everybody's been very skeptical, and I think we're gradually winning them over as we use local people and they get to know the show. And so, but this is a city that they're still making fun of the Big Easy and Dennis Quaid's Cajun accent.
Down there,
yeah. So it's a very tough crowd to win over, and I hope we do.
Apart from being potential carpetbaggers from the East, does the fact that you were two white guys doing this set up any issues for you?
Well, I mean, obviously, our fellow producer, David Mills, is African American. So he doesn't write the black guys. We don't write the white guys. We all write the human beings. And I've become so bored with that particular argument about sort of cultural primacy when it comes to story. The only rule that matters to me is how well did you execute?
Sure.
You know, good thing they let the boys write the girls or we wouldn't have Madame Bovary. Good thing they let, you know, the Gentiles write the Jews or you don't get Schindler's List. I mean, you know, at some point, you know, is the story worth telling? Did you want to tell it? Did you do your best
sure.
to tell it? You know, what else are we arguing about at this point in this late stage of the game?
You mentioned David Mills, who suddenly and recently died, who was a writer on this show. You'd worked with him and known him for a long, long time, yeah, David?
We were, we worked on our college paper together. He was 19 and I was 20 when we met. And yeah, he passed away 2 days ago on set. He had an aneurysm and passed away very suddenly. You know, I'm talking about it now like it's part of a normal event. I can't even get my head around it, to be honest with you. It's very strange. He loved the show for a lot of reasons, but not the least of which was it had brought him back to the point of writing television. You know, he had had some great success. We won an Emmy together, a couple Emmys together for The Corner. We'd worked together a lot in the past, but he had then gone off to try to do his own stuff in network and ran into a lot of the morass of network development that is just, you know.
Meaning NBC, ABC, CBS, as opposed to HBO.
Yeah, it would have been, you know, the kind of stuff that is, it would be comical if you weren't actually involved in it. I mean, Eric and I were laughing about a note that a network executive once gave Eric, which was, you can tell him. It's just,
she wasn't happy with the way people were fighting in the scene. And she said to me, Eric, couldn't we have the drama without the conflict? So, and, you know, and with a stunned silence, and I said,
that's one of the great ones, and yeah, I've heard many.
Yeah, that's a great one. And I said, well, no, I don't think so, really.
So, you know, David had 4 or 5 years of hitting his head against the wall, and he had the last couple of years, he was just blogging. And I feel like we sort of lured him back out of his room and from his blogging with breadcrumbs, with like, you know, teasing him with what this show could be.
And he's clearly, judging by his blog, a guy who loved music and kind of obscure, rootsy black music.
He was an incredibly astute fan of music.
David, you said that some characters in The Wire were in the model of Greek tragic heroes. What about the characters in this show? Do you have a grand literary narrative notion for them?
No, I think we're stealing small this time. I mean, really here, it's a little more documentarian than pure drama. I mean, The Wire really was not following any accurate reading of the history of Baltimore. We just made it up. Here, it's a fictional story, but we're trying to be rigorous about what has happened in New Orleans since the storm. So, for example, in this first season, when you come in, there's not a lot of crime as an issue because crime had gone away after the storm. Season two, by then, the crime had come back and with a vengeance. So that has to be dealt with. But you have to deal with stuff when it became relevant in terms of the actual chronology.
One can't help but compare it to The Wire, and I'm going to keep doing that for the rest of this conversation, I'm sure. But so far, and I've only seen the first three episodes, all of the characters seem pretty good. We haven't seen the bad people or the much of the dark sides of the good people. Does that change?
Yes.
Good.
We wrote the pilot, and then we brought in David Mills and George Pelicanos. And that was good because they didn't know anything about New Orleans, and David and Simon and I are in love with New Orleans, let's face it. And they came in and said, aren't there any bad people in New Orleans? You know, where's the darkness? And they held our feet to the fire, and it'll come.
But I will say this. I don't think on The Wire, with a couple of exceptions, The Wire wasn't really about good people or bad people. People were betrayed more by the systemic inevitabilities of the modern city than they were by you know, Snidely Whiplash.
Right, but as a viewer, there were murderers, and murderers whom one liked and indeed respected, as opposed to these people who are all, so far,
normal people.
Hardworking, middle-class, working-class people.
They're ordinary people. Well, now you've hit on the great holy grail of network drama, which is, can you do a show that is about regular people, that is not about doctors saving lives or gangsters killing people or people in, you know, making decisions about the fate of democracy in the West Wing? You know, if you don't raise the stakes beyond ordinary life, the ordinary life of these people who are living in the wake of this extraordinary event, can it sustain itself? And the answer is, I don't know.
David Simon and Eric Overmeyer are my guests, and in a minute I'll talk more with both of them about their new HBO show, Tremé. And we'll also hear from a great New Orleans musician who ended up as a character in the show.
Imagine 15 clubs in one little radius called Tremé, and all of them are popping hard.
And now, pretty girl, I see you got your hair fixed.
The trumpeter Kermit Ruffin. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Kohler, dedicated to helping people save water without sacrificing performance or great design. For more information on how you can save water and support Habitat for Humanity, visit SaveWaterAmerica.com.
This is Kurt Anderson, and I am back in Studio 360 with David Simon and Eric Overmeyer. They are the co-creators of Tremé, a new series on HBO that is set in New Orleans. It's about a whole bunch of people trying to get their lives back in order after Hurricane Katrina. And one of those characters is a very outspoken Tulane professor played by John Goodman. In this scene, he's on a levee being interviewed by a reporter.
Why should the American taxpayer foot the bill to fix New Orleans? It's going to cost billions.
Well, since when don't nations rebuild their great cities?
For the sake of argument, let's say New Orleans was once a great city.
Are you saying New Orleans is not a great city? A city that lives in the imagination of the world?
Huh. I suppose if you're a fan of the music, which has rather seen its day, let's be honest, or the food, a provincial cuisine which many would say is typically American, too fat, too rich, then yes, of course, New Orleans has its advocates. But what about the rest of the country?
Provincial, passe, hate the food, hate the music, hate the city. What the are you doing down here? You limey vulture mother.
And that character in Tremé, played by John Goodman, grabs the reporter's microphone and tosses it in the water.
By the way, it's not an NPR reporter.
No, it's
you guys are of the people.
It's obviously the BBC.
John Goodman is a famous television star. Unlike The Wire, you've cast people like him and Steve Zahn and Melissa Leo. Elvis Costello has cameo. Why did you decide to go that route in the casting?
Well, in the case of John Goodman, we thought of him because he lives in New Orleans. He just seemed like the first person we should go to for that part.
As to Elvis Costello, his River in Reverse album that he did with Alan Toussaint was the first recording session back after the storm.
And you essentially see them making that.
Right.
The studio where they made it.
Button, please.
Joe Fox, that piece, that moment that you and Sam just played, don't play that. At that spot, we need Amity and Breeze to really shine on the reeds, so you have to be out of the way.
So let's do it again.
Thought they could slip it by you, eh?
How about that?
Well, there is lots and lots and lots of music in this show. Was that part? That was part of the concept from the get-go that you would have long music segments.
Well, I think music was the raison d'être for doing the show. Was at the heart of it, and really, what we've been learning is how to do the music in a way that doesn't stop the show cold. That it's organic to the drama and it keeps the story going.
I've read, I think, an interview with you, Eric, where you said you actually have structured scenes around songs. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right.
How does that work?
Well, as we're working out the story and as our characters are traveling through the landscape, we think, who could Wendell be playing with? And what could that song be if we can get that group of people together? And we have a long list of New Orleans musicians we want to use. Well, we've used, David Mills counted it up and said, thought we'd use 50 or 60 local
really?
Musicians.
So you're like a full employment program for New Orleans musicians.
We're trying, but we need 5 seasons to fit them all in. There's so many of them.
You are the creators. How does that work with this two-headed beast? Literally day-to-day, script-to-script, how does your collaboration work?
Generally, we reach agreement. And when we don't, in a way, that was what, on a writing basis, on a story basis, what David Mills was about, which was we were a triangle. And you know, there's a lot of the writing room is basically 6 guys kicking it around and trying to make it better through the process of debate and argument and throwing out ideas. And you try not to let rank have too many privileges in that room because you want people to be able to speak and it gets better.
You want
better.
The best idea to win, not just who has it.
Right. So at the, you know, generally speaking, you know, Eric and I agree on a lot, but when moments come where we don't, you sort of have to sway the room, and of course David was a key vote. He was probably, you know, as a producer and a writer in the room, he was essential, and so that I've always found that dynamic works. I mean, on The Wire, it was often Ed and I would be at loggerheads, and it was either you in season 4 or George Pelicanos. It's that third vote. And in some way, if you can't convince the third vote, maybe there's something wrong with your argument, or you need to keep arguing.
So do you need, with the passing of David, do you need a new third vote?
We absolutely will.
Yeah.
I have no idea who would that be. It seems inconceivable that anybody could replace him.
Yeah, absolutely.
David, the Wire is routinely called the best television show ever. It certainly is among the best.
It's
on
the best,
one hand.
It's the best television show.
Good. I'm glad we can stipulate
it's better
that.
Better than Barney Miller. Really?
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
Okay.
We can stipulate that. But that creates a very high bar for your next project. Yeah.
Yes. There's a expectation, and I think if people come to the to Tremé expecting a cop show or expecting it to tread on the same material or content.
It's not The Wire New Orleans?
not by a long shot. And I think anyone showing up for that, it will be grandly disappointed if they want to see the same story told over again. And in fact, you know, that's part of the problem with episodic television is that if they love something about a show, they want to see it portrayed over and over again. When you give into that, you know, it's just, it's the long, sad road of hackdom. So the last thing that we can do is sort of look back at The Wire and go, what did they like about The Wire? And can we put some of that in Tremé? I mean, you know, this is another story. And at some point, you have to not care. You have to believe in the story and not look over your shoulder.
David Simon and Eric Overmyer, thank you very much, and good luck with Tremé.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Simon and Eric Overmyer are the creators of Tremé, which airs on HBO Sundays at 10 o'clock.
What is New Orleans, Phil? What is New Orleans? Part 2. Rebirth style. What is New Orleans? New Orleans is red beans and rice on a Monday night.
One of Tremé's great distinctions is its use of local non-actors in a lot of the smaller roles. One character is a trumpeter named Kermit Ruffins, and he is played by the real New Orleans trumpeter, Kermit Ruffins.
New Orleans is fried pork chops and macaroni on a Wednesday night.
In New Orleans, Jason Rhine caught up with Ruffins at the bar he owns in the 7th Ward on St. Bernard Avenue called Sidney's Saloon.
It's almost good 30. Jimmy, look.
Look like a man right there.
Hello, good evening. How you doing?
That's what I'm doing right here.
It's a boisterous crowd for a Wednesday just before noon, but Kermit Ruffins plays at least 4 shows a week, and Wednesday is his day off. He holds court in the corner, easy to spot with his signature red fedora. Kermit's daughter tends bar, and old friends keep walking in.
Welcome to my club, Sidney Saloon. Yours truly, Kermit Ruffins and the Barbecue Swingers, baby. Got all my classmates hanging out. Holla at them, y'all. Who the hell is that? New Orleans!
There's no question, he's a native.
I grew up in a little 9th Ward, right on Jordan Avenue, right about a block from where the Levees grew.
Kermit Ruffins grew up listening to R&B like the Commodores and developed a love for the trumpet playing in his high school marching band. But at age 15, a move out of the 9th Ward would mark the beginning of his musical career.
I left Lawless and went to Clark Senior High School, which is the heart of the Tremé. Had no idea about this neighborhood at all. Met Philip Frazier, and we started the Rebirth Brass Band. We started playing for tips every day on Bourbon Street, Jackson Square. And before you know it, we were getting on a plane, going to Japan, going to France, playing the festivals all over Europe.
In between globetrotting, Kermit always came back to the Tremé.
For that one neighborhood, they had so many bars, so many funeral homes, so many restaurants, and brass bands meeting up in a black and white at the bar before they go play the gig. Imagine 15 clubs in one little radius called the Tremé, and all of them are popping hard. I mean, some of the first people I met was Ernie Cato, Alan Toussaint, Danny Balk. I mean, I'm singing with Danny Balk on the corner for an hour. And then next thing you know, I'm recording his record with Ellis Marsalis. Crazy.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on the rainbow. Got that string around my finger. Lucky me, can't you see? I'm in love.
Even as his musical career flourished, Kermit never imagined he'd be cast in a TV drama along with his jazz buddies like Donald Harrison and Dr. John.
Yeah, Coco Robichaux, everybody. After the storm, my manager called me and said, David Simon wants to come to your house and talk to you about the HBO special, Tremé. I said, sure. Then I put two and two together with David with The Wire. And I didn't realize as the same person, you know?
Yeah.
And I was ecstatic, man, when I realized that it was gonna happen. It's about 6 real actors, maybe, and everybody else is straight up New Orleanians. I mean, everybody is in this thing. The Rebirth, of course, Trombone Shorty, friends of mine that's sitting right at the bar. My wife is in it, she's got a line.
In the show, Kermit doesn't solve murders or bust up crime rings. He just plays himself.
Listen, Kermit, you still got that gig at Vaughn's tonight, right? You got that going again.
Vaughn's still having it, man.
Yeah, crowd coming back, huh?
Coming back slowly but surely.
Yeah.
Coming back.
It's no coincidence the first time we meet Kermit on screen, he's behind the barbecue.
I love to pull that grill out at any given time. I mean, it's been hitched on the back of my truck now for about 2 weeks because I didn't want to take it off till the Saints win the Super Bowl. Now I don't want to take it off till after Mardi Gras. I've been grilling my butt off. I've been cooking Nutri-Rat, raccoons, stewed rabbits, turtle.
Nutria, wow. I mean, I think of that. When I think of Nutria, obviously, most people think of it as a pest, not something that you eat. But
delicious, man. Tender, beautiful, white meat. It's beautiful.
So how close is the real Kermit Ruffins to his scripted namesake? The answer might best be summed up in this scene with the character played by Steve Zahn.
Don't you want to get famous? You deserve to be famous. America needs it some Kermit. You just stand there telling me that all you want to do is get high, play some trumpet, and barbecue in New Orleans your whole damn life?
That'll work. It is crazy. They got me right on point. Yeah. When I read it, I was like, yes! I get the smoke on HBO.
Studio 360, I'm Jason Rhine.
At the end of this month, Kermit Ruffins plays New Orleans' big, wonderful annual jazz fest. You can hear a track from Ruffins' CD, Livin' a Tremé Life, at studio360.org. And while you're at the website, be sure to check out our blog, and if you haven't already, subscribe to the free weekly podcast of the show. New Orleans isn't the only low-lying waterfront city in the world that's threatened by rising sea levels, of course. And that, melting ice caps, rising seas, flooded cities, was near the top of the list of 21st century threats that were on the agenda of the recent climate change summit in Copenhagen. The delegates and leaders argued, they made pledges, they agreed to meet again. Not totally encouraging. Meanwhile, though, designers and scientists are already drawing up plans for what may be the inevitable. We asked Studio 360's Eric Malinsky to look into it.
It's Saturday morning. I'm driving along the Charles River with my father. He's a professor at Boston University.
And there's my building, School of Education, over there on the left.
My dad's really proud of how much the university has grown. He started teaching here in 1969.
This is the incredible new business school.
Oh my God, I remember when that was an empty parking lot.
It was. I parked there for years.
But this trip isn't just for old time's sake.
What's down there? What's
that? That's the Charles River. So you're telling me that the Charles River is going to be someday, is going to be right where I'm standing in front of my office?
How do you feel about that?
Not too happy. Is this really going to happen?
Well, that's the big question. Is this really going to happen? The estimates are all over the place. But Cynthia Rosenzweig, a NASA climatologist, says,
when we look at all the climate change projections, one of the ones of which we are most certain is that sea level rise will occur.
Why? The ocean is already getting warmer.
When water temperatures rise, the water occupies more volume. The ocean water is going to expand. Then beyond that, we have what we probably hear more about, which is the melting of land ice. The water that is trapped in the glaciers eventually makes it down to the sea.
Rosenzweig believes that the sea will be about 4 feet higher by the end of the century. And that's not enough to sink Boston, but it brings the waterline awfully close for comfort. Here's the other problem.
Flooding during a major coastal storm.
A warmer climate makes hurricanes more common. Urban planners usually talk about the once-in-a-hundred-year flood. But according to a new study by Tufts and Boston University, that kind of flooding could happen every decade. That's why Cynthia Rosenzweig wanted to work with the Climate Change Adaptation Task Force in her hometown, New York City.
Cities appear to be the natural unit of response to climate change, both on the mitigation side in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions because cities are more efficient, and then also on the adaptation side because so many cities are located on coasts. This is like the scene of the action.
The scene of the action has moved to an art museum, the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Barry Bergdahl is the architecture and design curator who put together an exhibition called Rising Currents. He commissioned 5 teams of architects to envision how New York could transform itself. And he's hoping to influence the real power brokers in the city.
People came from the Port Authority, and they did a reality check, of course, on things as they were developing. But they also, many of them, went away with certain wow effect. Wow, this is interesting. So that was very encouraging, because one of the messages that we want to get across is design has a very key role at the table. Design is not something that you come in and style what science does.
One of the designers in the show is Kate Orff. Her firm, Scape, was assigned the Gowanus Canal. That's a kind of disgusting strip of water in Brooklyn that could flood a nice brownstone neighborhood.
It was amazing when we did our research on the harbor that we learned that oyster reefs covered almost a quarter of the whole harbor's area and that they were capable of filtering all of the water of the harbor in just a matter of days.
The oyster reefs were destroyed for shipping. Kate's team is proposing new reefs that could diminish hurricane waves.
We have these received ideas about what infrastructure is, 15-foot high seawalls, and certainly, you know, I don't take that as the only way to think about infrastructure. I mean, a lot of what we're trying to do at Scape is to address some of the issues rather than being kind of a, you know, billion-dollar Band-Aid.
Cynthia Rosenzweig agrees. She doesn't think that the city should invest in big, expensive solutions right now, precisely because scientists still don't know how the climate is going to change.
But what we can do in design, and this is something that Kate and I and other designers have talked about a lot, is designing things now that can be changed further in the future.
Eric Begay and Mimi Huang of the firm N Architects are also part of the MoMA show. They're proposing soft barriers in the harbor to help protect the city. But they admit those islands might not be enough.
Well, if those fail, what happens to the buildings? The buildings need to also respond to their new aqueous condition.
They design these really cool apartment buildings that are not built from the ground up. They're suspended from the roof.
So you get an active waterline rather than a skyline.
So you're saying that, I mean, they're upside down and they're hanging. What is supporting the top exactly?
We're basically proposing that a structural bridge would be built.
Ah.
And the bridge, which is concealed once the houses hang from it,
right.
Provides not only the structure, but also the public circulation, so elevators and stairs.
And are there buildings that are like this already in the world?
We've asked ourselves the same question. we're not sure, not exactly, no.
But it's not just a concept piece. They're working with Arup, a renowned structural engineering firm that's built some of the most advanced buildings and bridges in the world. And they found inspiration from an unlikely source.
We love Wall-E.
The Pixar film Wall-E, where humanity abandons a trashed Earth for a cruise ship in space.
Wall-E is not just about the disaster event and kind of trying to solve for that, but trying to just, you know, imagine how urban living would change, I mean, not just the doom and gloom scenario.
I didn't know we had a pool.
Meanwhile, back in Boston, an architect has been pushing a solution that's also reminiscent of Wall-E. Kevin Schopfer designed another Boston that floats. His design is generating a lot of buzz and some backlash.
Anything from ugly to you've got to be kidding and expletives and, oh, the internet's full of it.
Boston Arcology, or BOA, looks like 2 gargantuan X's that overlap in a futuristic glass frame. And the whole thing's parked in Boston Harbor. If downtown gets flooded, BOA could be a safe house for historic landmarks, and it's got offices, condos, gardens, garages, and of course, retail space.
If you built one of these now, you're not disturbing anybody because you're not building in sensitive land areas. This is a economically driven solution to a lot of problems.
But how could we think of this floating city as Boston? Boston's a walking city. It's known for its neighborhoods, the neighborhood.
So yeah, this is not something I think that would be embraced fully right now. But I think as necessity becomes more and more apparent, then I think it becomes more and more of something that people could deal with.
That would be a polite way of saying we might have no choice.
Sea level rise and climate change are going to be with us basically forever.
But that's what I love about these engineering solutions. They have this gee whiz factor that you get from science fiction. They can replace that helpless feeling that a lot of us have with a sense of motivation.
That sounds kind of cool.
Even my dad's now excited for the future of Boston University.
I feel kind of bad I won't be around then.
Me too. For Studio 360, I'm Eric Malinsky.
The exhibition Rising Currents is up at the Museum of Modern Art in New York through the fall. You can see images of the architect's plans at studio360.org.
Did you think that your feet had been bound by what gravity brings to the ground? Did you feel you were tricked by the future you picked? Well, come on down.
Coming up, meet a pair of indie rockers from Tehran. But don't call what they do protest music.
Nowadays, whatever you do, you're considered a political person. If I want to put a political tag on my music, that means I'm going to expire in 5 years' time.
Rock and roll directly from Iran. That's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Kohler, dedicated to helping people save water without sacrificing performance or great design. For more information on how you can save water and support Habitat for Humanity, visit SaveWaterAmerica.com.
And dollars. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A new movie called No One Knows About Persian Cats has just come out. It is set in Tehran, in the underground music scene there. It's fiction, not a documentary, but it is based on the true story of two real-life young Iranian musicians, Negar and Ash, who are imprisoned for playing their music. The film follows their quest to assemble a band and get fake passports in order to escape to the West. The film ends before we know if they manage to get out of Iran, but I am honored now to welcome Negar and Ash to Studio 360. Hello.
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 So you guys are speaking to me from a studio in London, so I guess I should assume that you did manage to escape. How did that go?
Well, it was in 2008 after the shooting the film. We were invited to the festival in Manchester for real, and we left Iran. And well, we ended up staying here.
When we came out, we didn't think of leaving for good, you know, and escaping. We just came here for a couple of shows and to have a stage to perform on.
So you shot the film in 2007 or 8. How did that go? Did you have to do that secretly, furtively?
Well, yeah, it was late summer 2008 in September. We met Bahman, and he had this idea of making a film about underground music in Iran. We had to leave in 17 days, and it was a really fast process of shooting a film, and it was really risky in that city. He used a fake permit
and there was no time for you to think because you had to do the movie and leave.
Right.
There was no time for any other, you know, feelings, I guess.
But this film was the first big step to show the whole world that what you, whatever you see in the media and hear in the media uh-huh. about Iran is absolutely different than the reality happening in Iran. And the majority of people are well-educated, they're well into arts and culture, and they're very up-to-date with the world.
Right.
Yeah.
Were you guys ever arrested for playing music?
Yeah, I was arrested in 2007 when I was playing with my brother's band called Funt in some rock concert outside of Tehran, and it was a self-produced concert that we managed, and we got arrested, and I spent 21 days in prison.
Did you have a trial, or did they just decide, okay, we're going to let him out?
We had to pay like $2,500 fine.
Jesus.
Which we never paid, yeah.
The whole rock and roll idea of being against the man is, which is kind of fake in the West, is obviously very real there.
You see, most of the artists and musicians in Iran are not political, and us, for example, we are not political at all. We're not against anyone, and we're not opposing any ideology, you see. And this is the problem, because nowadays, whatever you do, you're considered a political person. I mean, if I want to put a political tag on my music, that means I'm going to expire in 5 years' time.
Right. No, and I completely understand that, and understand that your songs are not political in any sense. However, even if you're not political, the fact that this government doesn't like musicians like you puts you in a political position.
Yeah, well, they are the losers. We don't lose anything.
Uh huh.
They're losing to have the beauty of arts and
sure.
music, and they just pass away. And we try to live a life thinking about peace and beauty.
Right.
And we want to just share a message around the world. And they are the people who lose the game.
Let's listen to one of your songs called Human Jungle. That's Human Jungle by Take It Easy Hospital. If I'd heard that and know nothing, I wouldn't have said, oh, an Iranian band. I think I probably would have said, oh, that's a British band I've never heard of. Well, I wonder what kind of music you guys listened to growing up.
Well, back in the 90s, I remember that we didn't have access to CDs and MP3s or internet. So we would really wait for a long time to receive some tapes coming outside of Iran. And I remember the first time I listened to Bleach by Nirvana
uh-huh.
when I was like
10,
11, 12. Well, yeah. And before that, I remember my dad used to listen to Genesis a lot in home.
How perfect.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan of Genesis because of that. And
uh-huh.
Well, after I listened to Bleach by Nirvana, I started to think different, and I just grabbed the guitar and started to play music. And eventually, after we had internet inside Iran, we started to download stuff because we never could buy stuff, and that's how we managed to find different styles.
Has there been Iranian music that has influenced the kind of music you play?
Iranian music. I would say Iranian old poetry really influences us.
Yeah.
Because it's a music within the poetry in Iran, especially Omar Khayyam.
Mm-hmm.
He has a very musical ideology of life, and he doesn't live for yesterday and tomorrow. He only lives the moment, and that's what we are. We are momentists.
There's a new phrase.
And sometimes people ask us, okay, why don't you sing in Persian? And why don't you want to bring Persian culture to the whole world? And I would say that to bring one culture to another country, it doesn't always necessarily come with the language. And it can be various things like the melodies, like the you know, the scale of your songs and all those things. It doesn't necessarily have to be the Persian language that brings the culture.
You are, in addition to being momentists, you are globalists, I guess. But and you sing mostly in perfect English, but there's a track called Me and You that's in Persian, in the Farsi language. I want to play a little bit of it and then talk to you about it. مگه با تو چه بدم که تو با ما ستمت کرد ستمت کرد مگه هیچت دلم با تو نصیب مقامت کرد قامت کرد تو زمینی و مبارون تو بهاری و مشبنم تو همیشه خنده رو باش تو بسوز ریشه یه قم بازمت مدیدم و تو ترسم شه رسیدم ولی میوه جسمت با تو دست خوما چیدم. That is Me and You by Take It Easy Hospital. And despite my complete ignorance of the language, I really like that song. And I want to know more what it's about. What are the lyrics saying?
Well, that's a very old folk song from south side of Iran. But we did it in a different way for the first time. It's like the indie rock tune. It's a bit of a love song, but it really relates with our situation in Iran, with our home. And it says, what I did to you, that you're hurting me and you're against me. And that's what we feel about our country sometimes, that what we did against you, that that we have to feel this dark life in Iran.
And then it says all that's left from you in my heart is sadness. Means you've caused me sadness. And Ash, help me here.
It says, when I see you again, I'm going to be good to you and friendly and very positive about you. But I know that you're going to be against me again.
The last few years, there has been this official ban on, quote, Western and decadent music. What does that mean? What counts as Western and decadent? Everything you do?
Basically, beats, the drum beats, or the speed of the songs, or the basic idea of rock and roll that makes you move, that makes you have a good time. That's what they're trying to filter and censor, the sharing, the happiness, the positive side of music.
I want to ask each of you, is there a single thing, no matter how banal or tiny, that you miss most about Iran?
I miss the food a lot, really.
And you, Ash?
I think the food and the street language in Iran, really. The way we used to talk with friends and make jokes really fast and very clever.
I wanna walk with you down the foggy streets to the land of evergreen.
Is there an Iranian community in London that you're being part of?
Well, in London, everyone's really busy. Yeah, there's a big Iranian community, but everyone's like students, they're working. And in big city life, you don't get to know people that much. But we have good Iranian friends and some musicians as well that we meet. And that's really good to stay connected.
I want a tree on a porch and a swing.
Is it more pleasant to be living in London than Tehran?
You can't say that, okay, which one's better and now I'm happier here or not. It's you always give up and you get something else.
Well, you know, to be honest, in here we can do music faster and on time and very perfect. But in Iran, we used to do music with adventure.
Yeah.
And with the reality, you know. So it's a balance,
right,
you know, that is kept.
Right.
And in here is the market side and the fashion side that you never have in Iran. Okay, so in Iran, you concentrate on the feelings and the senses behind your music. I feel that wherever we lay our head, we feel that we are on this planet, and then we feel really relaxed. I remember when I was in prison, I was really making myself busy with thinking about, like, all other people in the prison, talking to people. In every different moment, you have to shape yourself with the moment in time.
Ash and Nigar, I want to thank you very, very, very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
And good luck.
Thanks. Thank you.
So, every day will be today, and tomorrow is no fear.
The movie No One Knows About Persian Cats opens in New York this weekend and across the country all spring. And that is it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you'll listen again next week. And if you live in New York or plan to visit soon, we have a special live taping, Studio 360, coming up in early May. The terrific singer-songwriter Josh Ritter will be our musical guest as he kicks off his national tour. There's more information about how to get tickets at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Rob Weisberg,
Aaron Calabria,
Jess Tiao,
Michael Guerriero,
Carrie Barber.
And thanks as ever to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, comedy doesn't always come easy to Ricky Gervais.
Fundamentally, I'm a storyteller more than a gagsmith. You know, I think you can watch the best 1,000 one-liners ever written, but you're looking at your watch after 20 minutes. One-liners are exhausting.
Ricky Gervais, next time in Studio 360, from PRI and WNYC.
Tea for the tiller man, steak for the sun.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.